Hi, welcome back to Wickedness. I'm Lenny.
And I'm Matt.
And we know we've been gone for a while because we were having some major audio issues that we're hoping we have cleared up.
Heck yeah. Hopefully this is good sound quality for you folks.
We're hoping much, much better than it used to be. But time will tell and we'll keep trying to make improvements. But we appreciate you guys coming back and listening again.
Heck yeah. No, this is glad to be back at it, actually.
Yeah, me too. It's been a break, but not an intentional break. It's just audio equipment. This has kind of sucked for us.
Well, we were fighting off, you know, aliens and skinwalkers and
Bigfoot
trekking through the Amazon basin. That's why we were really gone, right?
We were off on adventures and you guys didn't even know.
Heck yeah. And we're going to tell those stories. Did that sound believable?
Yeah, no.
No, it did not.
Nope. So I will say that this episode is coming up on our 2-year anniversary of the podcast.
Ooh.
We started it August 4th, 2 years ago.
Wow.
And Thursday is August 4th.
That's pretty wild when you think about that.
Yeah, it just kind of occurred to me that.
And quite a few episodes.
Yeah, not as many as what we could have been because we've missed quite a few recordings, but we're still doing good.
Oh, yeah.
We're on episode 82.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into this funness, all right? We are covering the Green River Killer.
Yeah, and actually, I'm surprised we haven't already covered this one. This one's like huge. It's a good one.
Well, we have quite a few big ones that we haven't touched yet because I don't want to throw all the good ones, all the big ones, the well-known ones in.
At the very beginning.
Yeah, like it's good to space them out. Plus the smaller cases and the mysterious cases that we've covered have been done because they've piqued my interest at the time.
Right.
And so, you know how, like, if you get something in your head, you can't just skip it.
Yeah.
No, there's no plan. It's my podcast or our podcast.
Well,
sorry.
It's more like your podcast. I just kind of sidekick it.
Yeah, you do. You're the best co-host ever.
Oh, please.
But, you know, like I get stuck on something and I can't just be like, well, that's not in the plan. It's whatever the plan wants to be.
So, I like it.
Yeah.
Just free flow.
Right? Why not? So anyway, this is going to be a 2-parter for sure. Possibly 3. Still figuring that out.
Awesome. So we not having a producer.
No. I am the producer.
So I just figure it out as I go. Yes. I like it.
Yep.
Okay.
Because I can do that.
Yeah, you can.
That's the beauty of having your own podcast,
I
guess.
That's true.
So let's jump into this. So originally, we should have recorded this back in June. And here we are, the very last day of July, going into August. And we have, every summer, we have summers filled with birthdays. I just kind of want to give my husband a shout out. Turned 46 in June.
Oh.
Totally did that. Our son turned 22 in June.
Mm-hmm.
Our oldest daughter turned 25.
Mm-hmm.
Our youngest daughter turned 19.
Yep.
And we celebrated our 17th wedding anniversary.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We have also been busy with that kind of stuff going on.
Right.
Our middle daughter, she's kind of the one-off. She does not have a summer birthday.
Mm-mm. And then we got my wife's coming up. She's going to be 26, I think, once again.
Every year I turn 26.
On the 4th.
Yeah. It's actually funny that we started this podcast on my birthday.
That is.
2 years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I know, right? Yeah. I didn't even think about it either, but
that
we did.
That is interesting.
Yep. We kicked it off on my birthday.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, it is cool because I'm cool.
So what's that with summer birthdays and the Green River Killer? How does this all?
So I'm just saying, like, I just wanted to announce that.
Because we've had a lot.
Yeah, we've had a lot going on this summer on top of trying to figure out.
Okay.
I'm trying to just get you guys caught up on life.
And you probably were maybe going to talk about it, but like just the Green River Killer up, you know, when we lived in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna
talk about the fact that we lived there and actually, you know, like, I guess, well, this is, that's a good way to segue in there though, babe, because you know, we've mentioned before that we lived in Washington State for about 8 years, and it was in a town called Puyallup, which is south of Tacoma in Seattle. And I used to work in Bellevue. So it's like a suburb of Seattle. And every day on my way to work, because I used to carpool with a friend of ours, we would cross the Green River. And every single time we went across it, I would be like, Gary Ridgway.
Yeah.
Can't say it.
Well, anytime you see the Green River sign for the river.
Yeah, Gary
you
Ridgway.
You can't help but think about the Green River Killer. I mean, just every time you see it, you just think.
Right. Or every time we went up to the airport to fly out, because mm-hmm. that's where he picked up a lot of his prostitutes.
Yeah.
I would think in the SeaTac area, I would be like, Gary Ridgway.
Right.
Green River Killer. Yeah. Whatever. So it was really strange living near and working near where several serial killers lived and worked and murdered people.
Yeah.
You know, Ted Bundy, all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Like, if you think about it, we were right there in their epicenter for 8 years.
For quite a few serial killers.
Yeah. Luckily, not while they were operating.
Right.
But yeah, we were right there.
And then you can only imagine what cases are going on now. What who are the new ones maybe out there? I mean, you hate to think about that. But
it's got it. There's,
you just wonder who's the new person that's doing these committing crimes.
Right.
And, in that area.
Oh.
That they're going to catch someday.
Hopefully there's not any.
Yeah.
But we live
in humanity. With humanity here.
We're part of the human condition, whether we like it or not.
Right.
So knowing the area where several serial killers walked at the same places that we did, I can't help but feel a little bit obsessed with these guys like Ted Bundy and stuff. So
sure.
Gary Ridgway, since we haven't covered him yet. And as always, famous to Lenny's Way, we're going way back in Gary's life.
Ooh.
Let's start with
him. Going back in time.
Right? Back to the future. So Gary Leon Ridgway was born on February 18th, 1949 in Salt Lake City, Utah. And can I just mention Ted Bundy also went into Utah and committed some murders, went to jail and stuff.
Sure.
Do you guys remember that?
Yes.
So why do all these serial killers seem to have this weird connection like this? They've been in the same cities, same states, done some heinous crap. What is it with these places?
I don't know. Like, tell us.
I don't know. I don't know either.
Figure it
but
out.
It just like kidding. I just wanted to point that out. But
FBI
anyway,
profilers out there,
right? Can you tell us why?
Right.
So his parents were Mary and Thomas Ridgway. Gary was the middle child. He had two brothers, one older and one younger. And I'm also a middle child.
So you
watch your back, baby. Oh, just kidding.
I'm watching it.
When he was 11, his family moved to SeaTac from Utah, which is a small town between Seattle and Tacoma, and it's an area that's known for drugs and prostitution, and it would later become his hunting ground. But we're covering the bases here. His childhood was rough, as most of these serial killers' childhoods are. His mom was said to be very domineering, and she and his dad fought pretty violently, even though his dad was said to be very timid. So his mom was most likely the one who was the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was a bus driver for a while and a major influence on his sons. He would always complain about the presence of sex workers on his route and how he thought they were horrible human beings, kind of just planting these seeds in Gary's mind.
Okay.
He also, though, worked in a mortuary. And because of this, many people thought it was also what influenced Gary and the reason that he practiced necrophilia.
Okay.
Which is kind of gross.
Right.
I don't know,
intrigue from whatever his dad's saying and talking about. And
yeah,
he's just
know.
Grasping at everything his dad says and just remembers it and
yeah,
locks
but,
it
I mean,
in.
Yes, as far as his complaining about sex workers can build a hate for them too, because kids are easily influenced by their parents, right? But
right.
I don't know what the being, you know, working in a mortuary would have to do with contributing
yeah.
to the necrophilia, but that's what
sure.
some people believe. I don't know.
Yeah.
His dad was said to have had a really big impact on him and his brothers though. So it's possible, I guess. But Gary was affected by all of this and he had a bedwetting problem all the way up until he was about 13 years old.
Mm.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
You know, we all expect little kids to have bedwetting problems, but you know, there's a link to kids who suffer from bedwetting, like and like sexual abuse and things like that. So you've got to wonder, right? But 13 is an age where you would think you would know to get out of bed and go pee. Like your body senses this stuff, right?
Yeah.
To top off the bedwetting, when he would wet the bed, his mom wouldn't just get up and change the sheets and clean up while he took a quick shower, because he is older, right? So he can take a shower on his own. She would take him into the bathroom and wash his genitals for him every single time he wet the bed. Like, he can't handle that.
Right.
Your 13-year-old son, you're 12, you're 10.
Yeah.
Like, he can't wash himself. But this traumatized me just reading about that. Like, I'm like, no, we have a son, and I would have never followed him into the bathroom after a certain age.
Sure.
I'm thinking by 6 years old, wasn't Cameron bathing himself?
Right.
Taking his own baths and showers. I would just have to start the water sometimes.
Right. And you're checking in and you're kind
of, are you good, buddy?
Right.
You know, like through the door, not invading his privacy.
Right.
Like, to go in and actually physically wash their genitals, this woman had an issue. That's all I can say.
Right.
He should have been able to handle himself. And then as a mom, you just go change the bedding, clean the mattress, give the boy some privacy. But his mom did not do that. And it's thought that his bedwetting was a result of his mom's crazy forms of punishment. So not only is she humiliating him by cleaning him up, or I would think it was humiliating, she is also the cause of it. When he would get in trouble, she would do things like freeze, you know, putting him in a freezing cold bathtub and making him sit there.
Oh, man.
He would also be verbally, physically, and sexually abused and humiliated by his mom. And he wasn't the only one. Apparently, she also did this to Gary's dad and his brothers. Like, she did this to all the males in the house.
Wow. So it was just a thing. This is what.
But could you imagine being a grown ass man and your wife is putting you in a freezing cold bath and making you sit there? Or sexually abusing you, physically abusing you, verbally abusing you. Like, why wouldn't you just leave?
Right.
I don't understand why people stay and stuff like that. But the whole family was under the control of his mom. Gary later told his defense psychologist that this actually led him to have mixed feelings toward his mom. He was right?
Yeah.
He was angry at her for it, but also sexually attracted to her for it. He had to be very confused.
That is confusing.
Which would make him so angry and confused that he would imagine killing her. Mm-hmm. This is what he told his psychologist.
Yeah.
Which, again, I could get on board with this. I could see why.
Yeah.
And as he grew up, he was found to be dyslexic. He struggled in school. He was held back a year in high school due to the dyslexia. He also only had a recorded IQ in the low 80s. Now, this is interesting to me because most serial killers test high, have high IQs.
Somewhat high, yeah.
He didn't. He also had violent tendencies, which makes sense. He watched his parents throw down with each other, yelling, complaining. His mom's bathing him and his anger toward her. He probably never learned to handle his emotions. And add in the low IQ.
Yeah, that's not good.
You've got a recipe for
disaster, for
crazy
sure.
soup.
You do. Yeah, with a low IQ and then just in dealing with the things, bad things. It's not good.
No. So as he grew up, his violent tendencies went from hurting animals and setting fires to hurting people, which, again, is normal, right? With his bedwetting, hurting animals, and setting fires, it's known as the McDonald or homicidal triad. And this was first proposed when Gary was 14 years old, and it was added to the American Journal of Psychiatry. However, hurting animals and setting fires wasn't enough for him before you knew it. He graduated into physically hurting people pretty early in life. So when he was 16 years old, he lured a 6-year-old boy into the woods and stabbed him through the ribs, hitting his liver. This was his first documented attack on a human.
Wow.
Yeah. And when he was asked why he did that, he responded, it was, quote, just to see how stabbing worked.
Huh. Yeah. Gotta start somewhere.
Right?
That's wild.
Yeah. The boy reported that after he stabbed him, Gary walked away laughing and said, quote, I always wondered what it would be like to kill, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine this poor 6-year-old boy, probably terrified.
Oh, yeah.
But thankfully, he survived the attack. Gary later told his psychiatrist that he was interested in stabbing because he often thought of stabbing his mom. He also raped a girl at school. So He has stabbed a 6-year-old boy, and then he rapes a girl at school when he's 16. Mm. He was never arrested for either of the crimes, and classmates in his high school actually described him as congenial but forgettable, which is really sad.
Yeah.
So, like, he's not the boy you remember, but he was never a problem causer, I guess.
Yeah. Just a middle of the row, but no one really paid attention to him.
Right. So he graduated from Tyee High School at the age of 18 in 1969. He married his 19-year-old high school girlfriend, Claudia Craig. He also joined the Navy and went to Vietnam, where he served on a supply ship and was said to have also saw combat. While he was in the Navy, he was known to frequently buy prostitutes, and he ended up getting gonorrhea, but that didn't stop him from having unprotected sex. It just pissed him off that he got gonorrhea. Mm-hmm. Like, wisen up, dude. This also followed a pattern for him. His victims were all sex workers. Also, while he was overseas, his wife Claudia had an affair, which ended the marriage only a year or two in. After serving 2 years in the Navy, he moved back to the Seattle area, where he got a job painting trucks, and he continued to work there for the next 3 decades.
Wow.
Yeah. He soon met and married his second wife, and I found a couple of different names for her. She was either Marsha Winslow or Marsha Brown. I'm not sure which. Either way, they were married and had a son named Matthew.
No connection.
With the birth of their son, Gary got very religious for a short time. He would go door to door preaching to people. He read the Bible out loud at work and at home. And he insisted that Marsha follow the strict teachings of their pastor, which I think I'll get into a little bit here. Seemed like a crazy, you know, religious sect.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
He would often cry after sermons and after reading the Bible. But even though he got deep into his religion, he couldn't kick his sex addiction. He continued to pick up prostitutes, and he wanted his wife to join with them and have sex in public in inappropriate places. Sometimes even in the same places where his victims' bodies were later found. Is that not creepy? You're taking your wife to get it on in public places where you killed people.
Yeah.
And he and Marsha participated in kinky sex or fetishes, which to each their own, but he choked Marsha one time during sex, which is how he killed his victims, which I find very eerie. Like, he's into the choking thing, but this is how he killed a lot of his victims. If I was his wife, ex-wife, and I learned this later, I probably would never be into anything kinky ever again. We're going missionary every time or not at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
No way. So anyway, eventually it all got to be too much for Marsha. So she left him and filed for divorce. 8 years after they got married, they were divorced in 1981. A year later, he was arrested for the first time for soliciting a sex worker. Prior to that, he had been arrested for choking a prostitute, but those charges were dropped, and I'm not 100% sure why. Also in 1981, police found one of his victims, but it was a long time before they were able to put him as the murderer and catch him for being the Green River Killer. So a lot's going on for him in 1981. Divorce, getting arrested for picking up a sex worker, getting arrested for choking another one, and then they're finding a prostitute dead in the Green River.
Yeah.
According to the women in his life, girlfriends and ex-wives, they said that Gary had an insatiable sexual appetite. He reportedly demanded sex from them several times a day. He would often want to have sex in public areas or in the woods. He freely admitted to having a fixation with sex workers, and he claimed he had a love-hate relationship with them, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He would also complain about the presence of sex workers in his neighborhood, but at the same time, he was using their services regularly. So what are you complaining about, dude?
Right. Yeah.
You're paying them to come to your place.
Yeah.
I guess in that sense, you're lucky they're nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the workers claimed that they thought he was torn between his lusts and his religious beliefs, though.
Just a battle he was fighting. But
yeah.
I wonder too, with his psychology for him, like he leaned so far to his religious belief that he was trying. He's so weak in his sexual immoralities, but he's trying to like be better. They can't. And he goes from one extreme.
That's very possible, right? We all struggle with something.
And some people they struggle. It's such a bad thing that he just goes 180 the other way, trying to anyway, but it's short lived.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good point though. So now that we know his background, let's start talking about some of his crimes. Throughout the 1980s, I'm just going to kind of do a synopsis here. We'll go in deep dive next week.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout the 1980s and 1990s, it was thought that Gary killed 71 plus women in the Seattle and Tacoma areas. Court documents said he had killed so many that he lost count, wow, which is pretty damn scary.
Yeah.
But the worst is that most of the murders took place between 1982 and 1984. Most of his 71 plus murders happened within 2 years.
Yeah.
Could you imagine killing that many people?
Mm-mm.
That's like, I don't know. That's like one a week or something. That's just insane.
Yeah.
The victims were thought to be prostitutes or runaways picked up along the Pacific Highway, and he strangled them all.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the bodies were dumped in the woods near the Green River, except for two confirmed and two suspected victims who were found in the Portland, Oregon area. And we'll talk about that too. They were often found in clusters, sometimes posed, most often nude. It was later found that he would return to their bodies and have sex with them, engaging in necrophilia. Most of the bodies were skeletons when they were found, so there are four victims that are still unidentified, which is really sad.
Yeah.
Gary also contaminated many of the dump sites with gum, cigarettes, and written materials that belonged to other people. Like, if they find this body and they find this chewing gum, they'll test DNA and pin it on them, and I'm in the clear. Yeah.
Right.
Which, to me, is actually kind of
smart. Not a bad
idea. Yeah, it's kind of smart.
Let's throw them off a little bit here.
He even transported some of the bodies across state lines, like the ones found in Oregon, mm-hmm, just to confuse police, to make it hard to identify the bodies. So his MO was to pick up women, usually prostitutes, and would often show them a picture of his son to gain their trust. After they would have sex, he would strangle her from behind. In the beginning, he strangled them manually, but many of his victims fought back and he would have bruises or other wounds. And whether they were fighting or just trying to defend themselves, they did leave marks on him. Gary was concerned these wounds and bruises would draw attention, so he started using ligatures to strangle them. He stopped doing it with his bare hands to avoid his own injuries.
Yeah.
He killed them in his home, his truck, or a secluded area that was out of the way.
Hmm.
The first victim of the Green River Killer was 16-year-old Wendy Lee Cofield. She was living in foster care and working as a sex worker, but it's important to note that Gary disagrees that she was his first. He says she wasn't. He says there were at least three more prior to her in the early 1970s, which is pretty dang sad.
Yeah.
And why would he lie about that?
Right.
But she's the one that they attribute as being his first victim, even though he insists she wasn't.
She wasn't, yeah.
Her body was found in the Green River in 1982, a week after she went missing. She was naked, but her clothes were wrapped tightly around her neck. And see, that right there, her body was found in 1982, only a week later, but they found a body in 1981. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So Gary's not, Gary's not
lying about
this.
It, yeah.
His second victim was 17-year-old Giselle Ann Lavorne. She had disappeared 2 days before they found Wendy's body. Her body was found in the SeaTac Green River area. The third victim was 22-year-old Deborah Lynn Bonner. She was missing in, she went missing in July of 1982. It was found in the Green River. A total of five victims were found in the Green River before police started calling him the Green River Killer.
Hmm.
And that's who I just listed.
Yeah.
These women were not just strangled and thrown into the river. Rocks were placed inside their vaginas. And it was known that Gary would come back to their corpses and have sex with them.
Ugh.
With rocks inside their VJs.
That's weird.
Like, yes. Dude is messed up. It gets gross. The bodies were not preserved, so that means he's returning to rotting corpses.
Yeah.
They stink, they have maggots on them, and he's having sex with them. This is...
That's...
But worse than all of that, he would do this most often when he would pick his son up from school. So he would leave his son in the truck to take a nap while he went and visited his victims and did this stuff.
Oh my goodness.
Could you imagine that?
Yeah, no, I couldn't. But
you have no conscience. Uh-huh. Like, obviously, you're a murderer. You have no conscience anyway. But but you're bringing your son that close to this stuff? That is just beyond anything I would ever even imagine.
It's bad.
It's really bad.
Yeah.
The stories of these murders scared sex workers in the area. 30 young sex workers went missing within a year due to Gary Ridgway. And the crazy part is that he was a suspect in 1983. And sex workers would ask him when he was trying to pick them up if he was the Green River Killer. Like he's going to tell you, yep, I'm the killer. Get in.
Get in. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Right? Yeah, get in. I am.
Yeah.
Hey, let's just try it out. Let's
right?
See.
I mean, what's it going to... Maybe he'll slip sometime and be like, that's me. And then you can take off
running. Take a chance, yeah.
I don't know, but...
Interesting.
Yeah, he was suspected by the prostitutes as well as the police at this time. The police even formed a task force in the early 1980s, and the task force included Robert Keppel and Dave Reichert, who periodically interviewed the then incarcerated serial killer Ted Bundy in 1984. I don't know if you guys remember that from the Ted Bundy episode our Ted Bundy episodes, but he did consult with investigators on the Green River Killer case. He was the one who offered his opinion on the psychology, motivations, and the behavior of the killer. He was also the one who suggested that Gary was revisiting the dump sites to have sex with his victims, which, as we know, he was. He also said if police found a fresh grave, they should stake it out and wait for him to come back to try and catch him.
Yeah, that's what I would have done.
Like, Ted gave them some really good advice, yeah. In my opinion.
Why wouldn't you?
Right? That? So, investigators also involved FBI profiler John E. Douglas, who wrote that Mindhunter book.
Yeah.
And he developed a profile of the Green River Killer for them. And as I said before, Gary was a suspect in 1983, but he passed a polygraph in 1984. So police just kind of discounted him, mm-hmm. didn't really look into him much, much more.
Yeah.
But a few years later, on April 7th, 1987, police collected hair and saliva samples from Gary and stored them, which was smart.
Yeah.
So even though he passed the polygraph a few years later, they're like, let's go ahead and get some of your DNA, though.
Right. That is smart.
Around 1985, Gary started dating Judith Mawson, who he married in 1988. This is his third wife. Keep in mind, he's got a lot of victims under his belt by this time. And I imagine him as this stinky, dirty guy, right? Like, I don't see him as being a clean cut, pillar of society or anything.
Right.
The fact that you can look at his pictures and see, I see him as a grimy person in his pictures.
Does he seem that way?
You should look at, you've never actually looked at any of his pictures, you should look at, just Google him.
Yeah.
He just looks like this stinky, dirty person to me. Kind of like Richard Ramirez.
Yes. Richard Ramirez was.
Yeah, like this is what Gary Ridgway seems to me too.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
The fact that you can look at that though and know too that he had sex with rotting corpses, it just puts this mental smell in my head. Like, I don't know. You know you can't smell things in your brain, but
yeah,
I can smell him in my head.
Right.
And it's not good. just mm-mm. Putting that
hot,
out there.
Hot garbage.
Worse, I would think. Like, he's like that dead animal smell in my head.
Yeah.
Like, it's just...
Not good.
No. I don't know how anyone could date him, and that's why I bring this up. Like, he's got three wives now under his belt, and and... They dated for a long time before they got married, but she married him. So she was interviewed in 2010 after Gary's arrest, and she said when she moved into his house while they were dating, he didn't have any carpet. And detectives later told her it was probably because he wrapped a body in the carpet, which is creepy.
Yeah.
She also told how he would leave for work early some days, claiming it was for overtime pay. But she speculated during the interview that he was probably committing murders during this time. She said she never suspected him of murder or any other crimes before she was contacted by authorities, though, in 1987. Mm-hmm. And she had never even heard of the Green River Killer because she didn't watch the news. So this poor girl
was
living blissfully.
I wonder how he treated her, though.
Well, apparently they had a good relationship. So... Author Penny Moorhead interviewed Gary in prison, and he told her that his kill rate went down when he was with Judith because he truly loved her.
Hmm.
Yeah. Of his 49 known victims, only 3 were killed after he married Judith.
Yeah.
Like, he really did love this.
I'm going to try really hard.
For this lady.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so knowing this, Judith later told a reporter, quote, "I feel I have saved lives by being his wife and making him happy."
Oh,
quote.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. And I agree with her.
Yeah.
I agree. Like,
as weird and creepy or whatever that is.
Right.
Like, hey,
But of all those victims that we know were his, to only have killed three after you got with her, maybe she did make that difference in his life that he needed.
Yeah.
But obviously not enough. He still did kill three people.
Yeah.
While he was murdering, he knew police were looking for him and that they had formed a task force. Unlike his third wife, he did watch the news. Yeah. So he's
well aware of what's going on. Yeah.
He also knew that sex workers would notify police if he seemed suspicious. So he didn't kill every sex worker that he picked up. He started trying to play it safe that way. He had developed some specific tactics to make them comfortable, including using his son. He would later say this only happened once or twice because he didn't want Matthew to see what he was doing, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he literally didn't just show pictures to gain people's comfort. He took his son with him on some of his sexcapades.
I just wonder how his son is now.
I know. Hopefully he's okay.
Yeah.
How he became a suspect in 1983 was when he failed to kill a hitchhiker he had attacked, though. So mm-hmm. he did make a mistake, which is common, right?
Yeah.
He used the same claim he had used in 1980, though, to avoid charges. He said he had choked the hitchhiker only in self-defense, saying she had attacked him first. So police let him go.
Mm.
Could you? I mean, I know it's the 1980s and people weren't big on believe the women thing. And you're talking about a sex worker, so there's a bias there. And all this kind of stuff doesn't make it right, but it's true. It's probably what happened here. So police were like, well, okay, dude, stop picking up sex workers, you know?
Yeah.
Police still kept tabs on him, though. And his home was searched in 1987, but no arrest was made because, unlike other serial killers, Gary never kept any trophies of his victims. He wasn't... He's just a slightly abnormal serial killer in this way.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't keep trophies. He had a low IQ, even though some of the stuff he did was way smarter than them, in my opinion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this is how it went down for him. So that's where we'll wrap this up. Part one, done. Next week, we'll have part two. Like I said, there might be a part three, but I'm not sure yet. So, you know, that's it.
All right.
Take it from here, love.
All right. So in the meantime, check us out at our website at wickednesstruecrimeandtheunknown.com. Reach out to us at wickednesstruecrime@yahoo.com and follow us on Instagram at wickednesstruecrime. Check us out on Anchor at anchor.fm/wickedness, where you can also support us by clicking on that support button. Most importantly, rate and review us on whatever platform you listen to us on so we can get our podcast out to more listeners just like you. And thanks for hanging in there while we worked out these technical difficulties. And we will talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.